Mormon Mental Health Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations are tax deductible and go directly to the costs associated with podcast production. Donations may also go towards research, material development, and counseling costs for those who can't afford them. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the promotion of health and general well-being for Mormons and their families. To support the podcast and its efforts, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. Thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Nisha Patel, and she is currently the director of the Community-Based Division in the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, where she has resided since 2002. In this role, she provides oversight, leadership, and management to programmatic, operational, and fiscal activities as related to improving and increasing access in rural communities. She has a degree in health education and promotion and has a passion for creatively thinking of ways to address community and public health issues. And in her spare time, she enjoys spending time with her family, which includes two young children aged 3 and 1. So welcome to the program, Nisha.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, this is Rural Health Week. Is that the right way to say it?
It is. It's National Rural Health Week. It's actually National Rural Health Day on November 19th, which is this Thursday. And so it's just a time to celebrate all the accomplishments across rural America that have been made over the past years.
Yeah, so it's really great to have you on the program because I know that just from a Mormon perspective, I mean, obviously there's LDS people all over the United States and other countries as well, but there are definitely rural areas in our country that are heavily populated by Mormon communities, whether we're talking about Utah or Idaho, Wyoming, even Nevada and areas of California. So I know that there's definitely many LDS members who currently reside in rural areas, although I don't believe that there's any specific statistics that would separate LDS population from others. Is that correct?
Not that I'm aware of. That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, so I guess the goal of today's podcast is, first of all, to kind of gather a little bit of information from you as far as what challenges rural communities are facing when it comes to specifically mental health issues, and how we as communities and specifically church communities can help in maybe playing a role in addressing some of those issues. So that's kind of bottom line what I'd like to cover today and have you share your expertise with us. So why don't we start with that basic question of what challenges are there currently that rural communities are facing that are either being researched or studied or that we know something about that's different from more urban areas?
Sure. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm really looking forward to this is because I think mental health and substance abuse issues are really on the forefront right now across the country. And we're hearing a lot about the challenges that communities face and a lot of innovative solutions as well that are being implemented to help sort of overcome some of these challenges. In rural America in specific, you know, we know just from data that rural residents are more likely to report being in poor mental health rather than their urban counterparts. But they also face a significant chronic shortage of mental health providers. And so psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors are all lacking in rural. We know that there's those challenges in urban as well, but it's significant in rural when you think about the other challenges that they face, including geographic challenges, just transportation to get to a provider. But you also have this stigma that is associated with rural because rural is very small. You know, everyone knows everyone in these communities. They're smaller communities. There's oftentimes just a number of providers that are providing services. You may have one primary care physician where residents are going. And so you've got this stigma associated in rural where it may be more challenging to get patients to come to the centers because of that stigma associated with mental health, along with having to travel long distances to receive the services. And also, you know, rural residents are less likely to be insured. They're also less likely to recognize illness as well. And so when you think about rural communities being so small and tight-knit, these are just some of the challenges that rural communities face.
Yeah, and there's about a fifth of the population that lives in rural areas. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
But only about 10% of health providers live in rural areas.
That's correct.
So that's a huge disparity itself.
Yeah.
Okay. So so what are some of the innovative strategies that you're aware of that are being implemented to address some of these challenges as far as, there's obviously a big move towards telemental health. Maybe we want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. But just from your department and things of that nature, what types of things are being tried or approached?
Sure. And I think what's really, really unique about the work that we do, we're the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. We're located within the Department of Health and Human Services. And so our charge really is to focus specifically on rural health issues. And so we're not just, targeting one specific issue. We're targeting challenges across rural communities that range from mental health and substance abuse to obesity to diabetes, just sort of covering the gamut of challenges rural communities face in addressing health care. I think what's really sort of unique with mental health is that you see that there is such a strong alignment with mental health and chronic disease. And so, when you look at some of the data, when you look at the frequent flyers in terms of the folks who are utilizing the emergency rooms the most, the top reason folks are utilizing the emergency room has to do with chronic disease, such as diabetes and obesity. But the second reason has to do with mental health. And I think that's huge in terms of some of the challenges that we're facing as a country in addressing these issues. The programs that we administer through our office, we do a lot of work. We do a lot of policy work, reviewing regulations. And so as mental health bills come across or as regulations come across, we have the opportunity to provide comment on ways that it impacts rural and making sure that rural is represented. It's really important that our voice gets heard. We also administer a number of grant programs that are not specifically geared towards the implementation of mental health programs, but are provide an opportunity for rural communities to be able to come in and develop and implement a program around mental health. And so when you look at just some of the work that's been done over the past few years through our grantees, we've got a number of innovative projects. Just specifically, we've got, and thinking about the region that we're targeting here, is that we've got a grantee in Montana that just recently closed out their project who had a three-year program to focus in on specifically mental health and then sexual abuse in children and child abuse in children. And so this, department was able to collaborate within their community, which is really key for all of their grantees, is to be able to find the key partners in their organization and within their rural community to partner with and be able to develop and implement their program. And this grantee was able to address the problem of child abuse in a number of ways. They were able to develop public safety components, some curriculums, clinical evaluation and therapy components, so they were able to use the funds to be able to make sure they had the staff in place to be able to provide the education that was needed, and really targeting children and, being able to develop materials that are nationally recognized materials and curriculums now and that are being showcased through our rural grantees. We've got a really, really innovative grantee in Idaho where there's, approximately 28,000 people living in this area, north central Idaho, including an Indian reservation. And these counties in Idaho are older, they're poorer, and they have higher rates of suicide and stroke death. And so they have an increased risk of diabetes and other chronic diseases. And this was a unique project because it was a project in partnership with 9 entities coming together to work with primary care providers, nurse case managers, community health workers, which I think are so key and instrumental in the development of a program. And they were able to use the funds to hire nurse case managers and community referral coordinators. And sort of work together as a team, that integrated approach, which we hear about so much right now in the healthcare world, which was extremely important. And just some of the results that they had was they're able to control, blood pressure. They were able to see improved results in depression and mental health. There were went sort of from poor mental health status to improved mental health status. And so I think that the funds are sort of helping to, break some of the challenges and barriers that communities face around depression screening and so forth. I think the key role that community health workers play here is that they're able to really, really get into the community and establish a relationship with people who are in the community, because they understand the culture, they understand the challenges that people face in the communities, and they understand sort of that stigma that's associated with mental health as well. And so I think they're sort of instrumental in playing that. You touched on telehealth, which I think is really, really interesting, because when you think about the lack of providers and the shortage of providers in this area, telehealth plays a key role in helping to sort of bridge that gap. And so we've got a number of programs that are focused in on telehealth, where you've got this hub site, maybe in an urban area, but they're providing services to rural areas. And so the provider may be in an urban location, able to, via telehealth, telemedicine, provide the services that are necessary in rural areas. One example we have here is actually in Texas, where the closest medical facility for mental health is at least 40 miles away for most residents. 1 in 10 residents have been diagnosed with depression or anxiety, and 35% have reported that they cannot get access to much-needed services. So through the funding they received, they were able to bring on a telehealth component, a mental health counseling, to be as effective as an in-home visit, which I think is really, really great. And the way they were able to do this was through a variety of ways. They've done telephone counseling, which has become an attractive, really, alternative to traditional face-to-face counseling, because the clients remain anonymous, which I think it goes back to the whole stigma. I think that's huge. And also televideo counseling, allowing the counselor to observe the client during treatment sessions and obtain additional visual cues. And so after this 3-year project ended, they saw improved overall mental health among clients in this county. It sounds like a small number, but it's really huge. In all, 45 unique clients were seen via telehealth, with an average of 8 mental health counseling sessions each and a total of 487 sessions. Community health workers led these classes for adults and adolescents. And then by the end of their classes, they saw, increase in knowledge and related to substance abuse. And so I think, some of these sort of models are innovative. You learn what some of the key pieces are, which is collaboration in the community, which is really, really important. What's really interesting is that, I was just reading an article this morning that came across my desk about how the internet and mobile technologies are really the response to the growing demand for mental health care. And so when you think about remaining anonymous, as I mentioned before, one of the pieces of this article that we read this morning was that, there are now online services that are being provided to help people 24/7 who are struggling with problems such as depression, stress, and anxiety, offering educational resources, courses led by mental health professionals, encouraging conversations with their peers. And so, you think about adolescents who are maybe up throughout the night, and teens who are up throughout the night and maybe struggling with depression or anxiety or stress, and they don't have anyone to talk to. This is an anonymous way for them to be able to contact someone by the telephone and be able to talk to them about what they're feeling. And so I think just the age that we're in with technology, there's sort of a lot of room for being able to really innovatively and strategically start addressing some of the challenges that we face around mental health.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know my own practice has just transformed since internet capabilities,
yeah.
And it just seems to be impacting all kinds of areas of mental health to be able to have technology, even apps, that people can download to help with mindfulness or journaling or tracking mood. There just seems to be so many different options that people can now tap into just right at their fingertips. So it's really good to see that those are being utilized. When you mentioned community health workers and, grantees and, some of these projects that you're mentioning, what types of credentials or professions are people coming from that start these types of programs? So what types of people get these things going to begin with?
Yeah, and so the funding that we offer through our office is really going to nonprofit and or public entities that are located in a rural community. And so a lot of times you could have, you know, a mental health facility coming in and partnering with a hospital that's in their community because they're seeing a high ER, you know, admission rate with people who are struggling with, you know, mental health illnesses, and then partnering with another organization as well. And so you're sort of looking at this collaboration of entities coming together to address a problem. We've got, when you kind of look at just sort of who we're funding, we have health departments, we've got hospitals, we've got schools who are coming in, you know, we've got, just talking about some of these mental health counseling facilities, just any sort of nonprofit entities that are looking to make an impact in their community and have reached out to other organizations in their community who are looking to make an impact as well.
And you also mentioned quite a bit now about stigmas. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I know that I've been to several trainings where rural therapists are definitely in a difficult position because, you know, like you said, their kids are going to school with the kids of their clients, you know, they're out in the grocery store and you're going to bump into your therapist. it's quite different, right, to be in some of these communities where, like you said, there's not as much anonymity. Is that the main stigma you're talking about, or are there others as well that you'd like to address?
No, that's the main stigma I'm talking about. I mean, when you think about rural and how small it is, it's kind of going back to what I said, everyone knows everyone. And so sometimes it can be hard with someone who maybe, you know, maybe suffering from depression, but who is not going to reach out to get care because they are concerned that others are going to find out that they are struggling with depression. One of the neat things that what we've learned from a couple of our grantees that we are funding is that they're starting to use different terminology. So instead of using the psychiatrist or the term psychologist, they're using, you know, health coaches. And so how do you integrate mental health into primary care? You've got someone coming in who's, you know, who may be coming in for their regular checkup, and how can you sort of have a behavioral health coach or a health coach on board to ask some of the questions that may be needed to ask to get to some of the issues around depression and other sort of mental health illnesses. And so we're starting to see a lot of that integration, which is helping with the stigma as well, because you've got kids who are going in, adolescents who are going in just to be able to get sort of those basic primary care services, but they've just got someone else coming in to ask certain questions and they can get to some of the challenges that are being faced without people knowing and being able to sort of remain anonymous.
And is there any concern as far as health coaches, you know, having certain credentials or training? Like how do you make sure that those are services that are appropriate and up to date on as far as just research-based, evidence-based, et cetera?
Yeah, and I think it depends. You know, you've got your health coaches who could be community health workers. And so, you know, I think when you think about the community health workers, and I'll get, you know, to talk about some of the resources that we have around this, they may not have sort of the clinical background that may be needed in terms of being like a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but they've got basic training and potentially credentialing depending on the state that they're in and certain requirements to be able to still play a role. And I think that's the main thing. A lot of this depends on each state. Each state is very different when it comes to credentialing and certain things. The health coaches all vary. And so when we talk about our grantees and who their health coaches are, most of them are people who have training in sort of health education and health promotion, but they may not necessarily be the provider. But what they're doing is that they're able to talk to the patient, and then they're able to consult afterwards with the provider and also potentially a psychiatrist or a mental health therapist to make sure that the right course of action is being taken place with the patient.
Okay. You mentioned substance abuse. So can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we're currently seeing regarding substances? And I believe we want to talk specifically about opioids.
Yeah, I think when you think again about mental health and just how much we're hearing about it and just the, you know, what we're seeing across the country, the same goes for substance abuse. We're definitely in a crisis when it comes to opioid use across the country, not only in rural but in urban as well. It's become a serious epidemic in our country. The usage of opioids in rural communities are on the rise. We know that, and it's become a public health crisis, quite honestly. And I think it's one that the entire administration, and in particular our department within the Department of Health and Human Services, has outlined as a priority topic because of the rising rates of opioid use, abuse, and overdose. And when you think about opioids, you're talking specifically really about prescription drug abuse and heroin use. And, you know, what's interesting is that it cuts across all geographic regions, and it also cuts across all socioeconomic statuses. And so, you know, I think that's what's really, really interesting, is that it can really impact anyone. We read a lot about just how it can start. I mean, it could be as simple as someone, you know, having an appendix removed, appendicitis, and having surgery and needing painkillers afterwards, and having those painkillers in the house, and addiction starting that way. And then what ends up happening is that they run out of the painkillers and they're addicted to it, but they're not able to access the painkillers, and they move on to heroin because you get that same high from heroin, but it's more accessible, it's cheaper, and it's easier to get. And so that's sort of where we're starting to see now, is that we're starting to see a little bit of a decrease in the use of opioids, but we're starting to see an increase in the use of heroin because of just those three things that I mentioned, with the accessibility and being cheaper. People in rural are more likely to overdose than their urban counterparts. I mean, we know specifically in Utah that the opioid overdose rates have been increasing, and Utah ranks the eighth highest for drug overdoses deaths in the United States. So I think it's really important, we're at this point sort of where we need to raise awareness about this, you know, to everyone, to all family members, to say this can happen to anyone. And I think what's going on now is that we're sort of in this movement of how can we increase the availability of naloxone, which is the drug that is needed to reverse an overdose effect. So if someone overdoses on an opioid, you administer naloxone and it reverses their overdose effects. And so I think, you know, we've sort of moved away from, okay, you know, we know we need to educate people on drug abuse and opioid abuse, but we also recognize that addiction is serious. I mean, we're dealing with something very, very serious here. It is not easy to deal with. And some people, this is something where if someone gets addicted, this is something that you're going to be having to learn to manage for the rest of your life. And so what's been really, really interesting is that when you look at what, you know, what's been going on with the naloxone, I mean, just in September, it was announced that CVS is selling this overdose reversal drug without a prescription in 12 more states. I mean, we're already increasing it now, you know, so we've got 14 states that without a prescription, you can purchase naloxone. So Utah is one of these states, you know, that I think it's really, really important. You know, Montana, New Jersey, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, just a number of states have already implemented this. So that if you know someone in your family, you know someone that is addicted to this, you get this prescription, you're sort of preparing yourself for if an overdose occurs, what can you do? Now, the second piece of that obviously has to do with the referral piece and making sure that we're not just, you know, administering naloxone and having an overdose reverse, but we're also making sure that we start referring patients and get patients the treatment that they need, and that's really important. I think where a lot of communities face challenges with is that a lot of patients are not looking for help. You know, a lot of people don't want that help. And so that's sort of this, I think, struggle that we're really starting to face right now. One of the key priorities that we're working on is, you know, increasing the naloxone availability and making sure that, you know, EMTs have it, the policemen have it, fire departments have it. How can everyone who is going to respond to an emergency have it available in case they need it, school districts and so forth. The second piece has to do with medication-assisted therapy, where, you know, we're moving away from sort of just general therapy, but having behavioral therapy combined with another medication to sort of help you start weaning off the addiction. And so, you know, again, really, really big. I think the important message for me here is just to raise awareness of how serious this is. And finding ways for the community to really, really get involved and start educating the community on the importance of this. And the main message being that it really cuts across anyone, everyone, all ages, all socioeconomic statuses.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes within kind of Mormon culture, there's this notion that, oh, Mormons, they don't deal with drug addiction, right? Because mm-hmm. we are, you know, part of our religious observance means staying away from not only illicit drugs, but alcohol, even things like coffee. And so there's this kind of sense that somehow we're protected as a population from these statistics. And my experience has been that that's not the case, that many, many Mormons and LDS families deal with addiction and, you know, are very much dealing with some of the issues that you're describing right now.
Right. And, you know, I have to say, I mean, and I can totally understand that, you know, my background is I'm Indian. And so our culture is sort of the same way. I mean, this is something that we don't talk a lot about in our culture. We don't think people are abusing drugs in our culture. We don't think people are doing opioids. But I can tell you that it's definitely there. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we just need to learn how to raise awareness so that, you know, sort of different cultures are understanding that it can impact anyone. It doesn't matter sort of where you live, what your culture is, what your religious beliefs are, and so forth. But it's impacting everyone now. And so how can we make sure that people really understand that and that that they're starting to sort of look out for the signs of any sort of addiction within their family? They're talking to their kids about this. They're finding out, communicating with them in their schools, you know, to find out what's going on. You know, I live in Maryland, and I live in an urban area. Right down the street from me is our high school where my kids are going to be going. And one of the reasons we moved where we moved is because it's one of the best school systems where we live. And there was a huge article that just came out last week about the use of opioids in Montgomery County, Maryland, right where I live, right down the street, and how it's been impacting our schools. And so it's an eye-opener for me. At the same time, it's sort of like, how can I make sure that my kids are educated as they're getting older so that they know that this is a huge crisis that we're facing? Not only with this, I mean, drugs overall, but right now, this is really serious for us.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, that whether you're in private school systems or higher socioeconomic systems of, you know, where sometimes people think those are just better schools, that does not necessarily mean that there isn't a drug crisis happening in those schools as well.
Right. And I would also just say, just making sure that I think folks understand that, you know, someone who's, again, when you talk about stigma, I think this is a big piece of it too, is that when you think about the socioeconomic statuses and how it cuts across all socioeconomic statuses, you know, having a child who's addicted to drugs, or having, you know, someone else in your family addicted to drugs and not talking about it because of the perception of what people will think. And I think that's a huge sort of, you know, I think challenge as well. What we've recognized and what we're starting to see is that communities are really starting to find a way to engage people who have family members addicted to opioids. And so how can you bring them together or talk to one another about their challenges and their struggles and what they're trying to do to help them? I mean, a lot of this is, like I said, the person has to want help. And if they don't, you're sort of in this position of, what can I do? You know, what can I do to be prepared in the event that something happens?
Yeah, I agree. And I think just thinking about, you know, how to make some of this information useful for church communities, I think that if somebody's teaching a lesson on, we call it word of wisdom, you know, in Mormonism, or to just to be mindful to talk about it in a way where it leaves the possibility that somebody in that congregation may be dealing with these issues. I think oftentimes we otherize, we say, oh, well, those people, you know, stay away from those people or don't get involved in this, when you might be talking to an audience where they're sitting right in front of you. And just be really careful about making sure that we're inclusive in our language.
Very true. Yeah.
So, let's talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act and the impact that it's had on rural America, and just some of the options that you may want to talk about as far as helping people get the health care that they need.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think we've come a long ways with the Affordable Care Act, particularly in rural areas, and we've still got a long ways to go, and there's a lot of reason for that. I think a big piece of this is helping people understand the importance of obtaining health insurance, and that's one piece of it. But the second piece of it is that once you get health insurance, how do you access care? Why do you need to get the care? Why do you need to get the preventive services that you need? Helping them understand that piece of it is extremely important. I think we're doing a great job, but we've definitely got some work to do. There's different types of health insurance marketplaces. You know, there's those who are using the federal sort of platform, healthcare.gov, and they're and then you've got states that rely on the state officials to implement it. And then you have states who have their own exchanges called the state-based exchanges. Utah, for example, is a federally facilitated marketplace, which means that the government is operating their health insurance. And so a lot of that has to do with the politics, and, you know, those decisions are made at the state level. We are currently in the third open enrollment period, which started November 1st and will continue through January 31st, 2016. And so it's really at this time that consumers go back to the marketplace where they can obtain insurance. If you've got insurance, update your information and either renew your coverage or shop for a new plan if you're looking for that. And then this open enrollment period, really in comparison to previous open enrollment periods, we'll be using the most recent 2016 household income to determine eligibility for the, you know, if you're eligible for any subsidies, and I think that's important to know. When you think about rural and just how we're doing so far over the last few years, you know, over like about approximately 1.5 million people of individuals who've selected, you know, plans in 2015 were rural residents. And so across regions and within states, the enrollment varied greatly. States, you know, there's a piece of the Affordable Care Act that I think some folks may know, may not know, but there's a Medicaid expansion where some states opted to expand Medicaid, meaning that it opened up the eligibility to others who could potentially be eligible to receive Medicaid, and other states who opted not to expand Medicaid. And so if a state opted to expand Medicaid within their state and you meet a certain income level, poverty within the 400% of the poverty income level, federal poverty income level, then you're eligible to receive Medicaid. And so we're seeing some increases there as well, where Medicaid has increased percentage of enrollment, you know, obviously in states that expanded it versus states that did not expand it. I think that's important as well for folks to understand. And so rural residencies really typically have greater frequency of chronic disease, and they're more likely to be eligible for the plans that are available through the Affordable Care Act, given their medium household income. As of 2015, the percentage of non-elderly, meaning under 65, rural uninsured is now less than urban. The West, in particular, has the second highest rate of uninsured regionally, second to the South. So I think the main message here is, how can we really do some outreach and enrollment efforts? We're doing a lot in our office around that, and just with, across the department, with being able to educate people around the Affordable Care Act and how it can benefit them, and then also finding ways to get people enrolled. We've actually come out with a rural best practices guide that we've developed and that is available on our Rural Assistance Center, along with a number of other resources I think folks would find extremely valuable. And that website is www.racraconline.org. It's sort of a one-shot stop for rural. And so we've got a best practices guide for anyone who's looking to find innovative ways just to get word out about the Affordable Care Act and the benefits and how to provide some sort of outreach education to people so that they understand the benefits of the Affordable Care Act to their health. And so what we're learning really is, you know, some of the key ways that people are, some of the key strategies that people are using to get people enrolled have to really do with the word of mouth. I think that's always important, people talking to one another. There's also, you know, you've got people who are working within each state, navigators who are there and available. Every state has them, counties have them, trained people, certified application counselors, navigators, people who know the law and can help you determine what the best insurance plan is for you and or your family. Materials, I think that's always important. Just if you're at a grocery store and you have an opportunity to put some materials up to educate consumers, take that advantage. Just where are people coming, particularly in rural, you know that there's specific places that people are going to. So is it the local tea shop? Is it the local coffee shop? Is it a certain grocery store? And how can you get materials in there? Or, for example, what you're talking about with the churches, how can you put examples so that people understand the importance of health insurance and how it can benefit them? Radio commercials, you know, just getting the word out, I think, is really, really important.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about possibilities that, you know, trying to think through the Mormon lens of how congregations are set up. You know, it's difficult because Mormonism is very top down. So it's kind of like if the main leadership comes up with a program or implements a program, then it trickles down to all the local, you know, congregations. But you might have, at the same time, there is local authority. And I think, you know, as I've served on many of these, they're called ward councils and leadership meetings, part of what local churches are doing, like in most other religions, is providing help, you know, whether it's financial help or social help, or, you know, there's issues that come up with the members of any congregation that are complicated and difficult and oftentimes even chronic. And one of the challenges I think that Mormonism has within the congregations is that we have this lay leadership. So it's not like you have a paid pastor who has been around for 30 years and knows the community really well. People are kind of moving in and out of positions in Mormonism all the time, right? And so we're trying to help local congregants with basic needs, while at the same time there may be chronic issues happening that can easily overwhelm the leadership, you know, within a local ward. So what types of ideas do you have as far as, you know, kind of simple things that either Relief Society presidents, so women, you know, who are in the leadership part of the church, or even bishops and elders quorum, who, you know, people who are kind of in these leadership positions to help Mormons tap into some of the resources that you're talking about? Because they're not going to be able to, you know, write grants or create programs that are long lasting. But I think that they can have an impact on, like what you're saying, you know, helping people know about resources, maybe helping people sign up and get health insurance, may tap into community centers that are already in existence. What ideas might you have for that?
Yeah, I think the main thing is that, you know, first of all, just becoming knowledgeable about the basics of the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, I don't think it's expected that anyone is, you know, gonna know the full extent of the Affordable Care Act, because it is very complex and there is a lot of pieces to it. But when you think about what we're really trying to accomplish, it's being able to get people to understand how health insurance is going to benefit them. And so I think the main thing is, like, how can you become knowledgeable about the Affordable Care Act and what's going on within your state? How is your state's health insurance exchange being run? Is it the federal government that's running it? Is it a state-supported exchange? Has your state expanded Medicaid? Because if it has expanded Medicaid, you're able to reach out to another population to be able to help them get enrolled. If it hasn't expanded Medicaid, you may face some barriers there. I also think that it's important for to be able to know who within the state and particularly within the county is working on the Affordable Care Act. So who are the application counselors and the navigators within the state? Where are they located? And get them involved, because they're the ones who really understand the Affordable Care Act, but they'll understand all the various plans that are being offered in the state, the insurance companies that are part of the Affordable Care Act within the state, and they're also going to be able to help people know if they're eligible for tax subsidies to be able to get, you know, because their income level may meet that threshold. And so I think that's important. So, you know, a couple of the things that we have found that have been successful, and it's been within a faith-based organization, is that where they've had, you know, one of the counselors come to the church on a Sunday when some of the services were going on, and then they were able to sort of be able to build that in after everything was done, after services were done, and had someone there on board to be able to help provide assistance and get people sort of educated and enrolled right there. So I think that's, you know, something that has worked really well. And then also thinking about where else people are congregating, like where else are people going? Where else are people meeting up where these sort of services can be, you know, provided? When you think about your state, you know where some of these main areas are where people meet up, and that there's opportunity to be able to educate people.
Yeah, so I'm definitely hearing opportunities just using Mormon language for, you know, firesides or trainings, community outreach where you have a special Saturday event or something where you bring somebody in who can help educate. There's also potential for callings under the welfare systems for members of the congregation to become educated and connected with people in their local, you know, counties and state entities that can help. So I think those are just all kinds of just translating what you're saying into Mormonism. To just kind of throw out some ideas for local leaders who may really be struggling with knowing how to meet the needs of their congregants, which I think is something that most wards struggle with at some level.
Right.
Great. Okay. What, as far as some of the basic challenges as far as, I know you mentioned that rural communities, if I heard you right, seem to be doing actually better than urban as far as becoming insured. Is that what you said?
Well, I think it's still, no, you know, we still have, it's actually, I have to look at the exact numbers for you, but there's still, I think, more of an increase in the urban areas where people are getting insured versus rural.
Oh, okay.
I think a lot of that has to do with the Medicaid expansion, quite honestly, because a lot of the states that have not expanded Medicaid are primarily rural states that have not expanded them, and so that's a huge piece of it as well. But all that to say, there are still approximately, like I said, 1.5 million people who were rural residents in 2015 who selected a plan, and so the impact is definitely being made. There's just still some more work to do.
Okay. And what can somebody expect, you know, as they begin to become enrolled and have an insurance plan, what can they expect that to mean in terms of accessing mental health services?
So the mental health and substance abuse treatments, they are included as part of the essential health benefits, which every plan is mandated and required to offer. And so there's specific essential health services that each of the plans that are part of the Affordable Care Act have to offer, and mental health services is one of them. I think that's a huge benefit right there. I mean, these plans are specifically trying to maximize access to primary care providers and preventative services. So there's, you know, reduced co-pays and other out-of-pocket sort of costs for enrollees. And I think as mental health illness, as I mentioned this before, is often comorbidated with chronic disease, it's that improved access to primary care services is the potential sort of major benefit to addressing an individual's mental health needs. And so I think that's going to be the big thing is, you know, we're making such a push in terms of being able to integrate mental health into primary care, and this ties into it extremely well, because if folks are able to access insurance through the Affordable Care Act, they're increasing, obviously, their options and availability to be able to find a qualified healthcare provider, primary care physician that they're comfortable going to, and then knowing that mental health services is one of the benefits that is going to be included as part of their plan. So whether that's through their primary care physician and that's already been integrated in sort of those services, or they're able to find a mental health specialist counselor just within their plan themselves and be able to utilize the services that way.
Yeah, I think that's just so pivotal as far as, again, having leaders of our church kind of support these measures, because one of my mantras is always like, a good bishop knows that they're not a therapist, and a good therapist knows they're not a bishop, right? And so it's like when you're having people come through your office with some of these issues, it's just so important to have places you can refer and get the quality of care that people need. So I just really appreciate all the information you've shared with us. I guess I would just ask at this point if there's anything I'm not necessarily asking you about that you'd want to make sure that gets covered in this interview.
Sure. I think the one thing I would like to mention, I mentioned our website, this website called the Rural Assistance Center, and, you know, the website, the www.raconline.org. And, you know, we consider it a one-shop stop for rural in the terms that there's funding opportunities on there, and there's a wealth of resources on there. And one of the key points I really want to point out in relation to this conversation is that we've been working to develop evidence-based literature and programs to be able to serve as a resource for rural communities. And so we have a toolkit up there on mental health and substance abuse that we've developed through sort of extensive literature reviews of models around the country, and making sure that we know the outcomes that were captured and sort of the impact that was made. And we've turned that into this sort of self-learning, easy-to-use toolkit. And so when you go on the website, you'll see 8 modules underneath the mental health toolkit. So if anyone's looking to address mental health in their community or develop a program to help address mental health community and implement it, it's going to give you ideas on how to determine where to begin. Sort of how do you adopt an evidence-based intervention? So you're adopting practices that have been proven to work. How do you evaluate a program? You know, sort of those things I think are really important. So it's like a beginner's toolkit. And I would, you know, really encourage folks to go on there. But you're also going to be able to see, you know, some of the examples I talked about with these programs and some of the innovative strategies. Part of this website has something called an innovations hub. And that consists of models around the country that have been really innovative in implementing their projects and providing some creative strategies around all topics, mental health being the main one. And, you know, you're going to see information on those models as well. And so are they considered an evidence-based model? And what have they been able to do? You know, like, how did they, how did they implement their project? What were some of the outcomes they captured? How did they evaluate their program? And there's going to be contact information. So now they've gotten to the point where we want to share what we're doing. We think it's replicable in another community. Please reach out to us so that we can provide more information to you. And I think that's just another opportunity as well. For folks to be able to find a resource as they're looking to address this issue within their community.
And so you mentioned reaching out to you as far as your department, that people can do that if they're wanting either more information, more resources, information on how to get something started within their congregations or things of that nature, that those resources are available to them.
Definitely. I mean, we've got, the resources I just talked about, they're all on the website that I mentioned, the Rural Assistance Center. However, we've got a number of funding opportunities as well and grant programs. And so, you know, around telehealth, ones that can be used to address mental health. And so, yes, if you reached out to us, we'd be able to provide you information on those, even talk to you about, you know, thinking it through in terms of what you would need to do to get a grant application started. Who do you need to pull together in your community? How do you pull that information together into an application and then, you know, see if it would get funded? And so we would be able to provide all of that sort of information along with other resources that we have that would be helpful for communities.
Well, that's very helpful. And I'll make sure that I link to all these things that you're mentioning when I release the podcast as well. So that will be available.
That sounds great.
To link to. Well, I just can't thank you enough for your time. This has been very helpful. I think this is just such an important topic, and just rural health has, I know that I live in Wichita, Kansas, and I'm currently the president of the Kansas Marriage and Family Therapy Association. It's something that comes up all the time as far as just trying to reach out to the communities where, like you've mentioned, there just aren't as many resources, and there's a need, and I just think it's so important to be addressing these issues wherever it is that we may reside. So thank you so much for your time and for coming on today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, unknown ways,
unknown ways
before
me roll,
hiding rock and treacherous shore, chart and compass came from me. Jesus, save.
Obey thy will
when thou say.
When
see. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. When at last I'm near the shore and the fearful breakers roar, may I hear thee say to me, fear not. Twixt me and the peaceful rest. Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear thee say to me, fear not.